Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Thursday, June 13th. I'm Ray Graff. Time once again to convene the Science Forum on Vox Pop, and we've assembled our panel of experts to field your scientific questions. The number to call is 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551, or if you wish, if you're shy, email us, voxpop@wamc.org, voxpop@wamc.org. But again, the number, 800-348-2551. Oh, yes, it's the Science Forum. It comes up right after the news. Hello once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Time to reconvene the Science Forum. The experts are here champing at the bit. The number to call if you have a science question, 800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. You want to tweet us? Go ahead and tweet us. It's at WAMC Vox Pop, or you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. But the number, once again, is 800-348-2551 if you want to call in. Now, it's a science forum, so let's have our panel of scientists sign in, please.
It's Barbara Brabets. I'm a biochemist from SUNY Cobleskill.
I'm Jim Pickett. I'm an organic chemist, and I'm mostly retired.
I'm Ed Stander, and I'm on vacation from SUNY Cobleskill.
Okay.
Astronomy, geology, and whatever Ray can't answer.
You know what? This is amazing. We have three very relaxed people here. We have two college professors on break, semi-retired person, and then we add a working stiff to the crew. And
someone's got to do it.
Tell us who you are.
I'm Roger Giboni, and I'm an electrical engineer. And I own a company called Rogers High Fidelity.
Yeah, well, you're the tube guy. And anybody who's a friend of mine and family has been known to say, well, you shut up already about the tube gear. I talk about it a lot, and it's nice to have you here, Roger. Before we get started with the calls at 800-348-2551, since we have a tube guy here, I always wanted to get some insight into EMP, electromagnetic pulse. It has always been said since they more or less discovered in 1962, late 50s or 1960, early 60s, that it fries solid state, if it's powerful enough and in the right spot, it'll fry solid state gear, and yet tube gear can be somewhat immune to the effects. Can you tell us a little bit about EMP and why tubes are better for that?
Nothing like starting the day off with a three martini conversation.
All right. Well,
right?
By the way, it's about time I had one.
Okay, so EMP, what is EMP? Electromagnetic pulse. It's an electrical phenomena generally associated with a nuclear event. And when you have a nuclear event, you get this big expulsion of neutrons, but you also get electrons. The electrons ionize the air around it, and then the electrons regroup. So you get a big electric field change. You get a big magnetic pulse associated with it. And it's picked up in our electronic equipment and our electrical equipment, electrical distribution equipment. Solid state gear versus vacuum tubes.
Yeah.
They both amplify, but because of the physics of the way they operate, they operate and are more or less susceptible to that big pulse of power that comes through the associated equipment. Solid state devices have very thin, molecularly thin, called a membrane, that is the amplification zone. Whereas in a vacuum tube, you have large spaces between the electrodes, which allow them to be much more robust in that kind of an environment, an EMP environment.
So we think of air as a conductor, but it's really a good insulator too.
It is. And there's a little known piece of vacuum tube lore. Ray probably knows this, but in the late 70s, maybe early 80s, a Russian pilot defected, I think from North Korea, flew a MiG-25 into Japan. And naturally, our CIA was more than happy to help him land and go over his airplane, and was full of vacuum tube electronics, which they later figured was because the Russians or the Soviets at the time were building equipment to be robust against an EMP environment.
Now, we can still harden our infrastructure without going to that level, though, right?
There are things that can be done, absolutely, and they are done. We design electronic equipment. I mean, the only people designing with vacuum tubes today are audio people.
Right.
So the rest of the electronics world does design equipment to be robust in an EMP environment, but it's hard. It's a very difficult environment.
You know, it's funny. The sun will have coronal mass ejections
all the time,
and so we had one in the 1850s.
Yep.
That there weren't a lot of electronics then, but it could cause some havoc for telegraph operators.
But bear in mind, you've got the Van Allen belts that shield a lot of that. So, you know, it's when you get they call upper atmospheric explosions. They're within the Van Allen belts, but in the upper atmosphere that cause those problems.
That's why we're designing miniature Van Allen belts to go around our electrical equipment.
There you go.
There you go. Our number here is 800-348-2551. Ed Stander is here, Barbara Brabets, Jim Pickett, and Roger Giboni. Let's go to the phones, 800-348-2551. Todd in New Lebanon. Todd, you're on.
Hello.
Hello.
Why in the summertime do nice, fluffy white clouds tend to clump together?
Why do nice, fluffy white clouds tend to clump together? Who wants?
I'll start with just the idea of what's going on in the atmosphere. You have water vapor, that is a gas that when you think of steam, you think of kind of like the condensate on your mirror in your bathroom after a shower. But realize that true, honest to goodness, gas form water is transparent. You're not really seeing it. I mean, it does influence color, but it's clear. When it coalesces is when you get that white scatter of light. And so the coalescing allows us to see the water vapor in that liquefied form that you have, or in the case of some clouds, it's actually as ice up there. So you've got, it's not that the clouds are the only place where water vapor is, but it's a coalescing and then a conversion from that steamy vapor to other forms. I'm trying to do it without using my hands. It's hard on the
video. Why? Go ahead.
Use your hands.
That
Bart.
One guy is watching online at WMC.org. Right. Feel free. Who else?
Go for it.
Okay. Well, during the course of a day in the summer, as it warms up, you can evaporate a lot of water from the ground. So that's why many days start off being clear and then cloud up progressively during the day, especially if it's been moist, if it had rained recently, not real dry. So as the day progresses, then you see more and more of the cumulus clouds, and they will appear to be jammed together simply because there are more of them.
There's only so much water that can be held at any one temperature in the atmosphere. And after that point, if more water enters that atmosphere, it has to come out of the gas phase and end up as liquid water or solid water. And that's the cloud.
And I was actually, you picked right up on my thought there, that the altitude at which clouds form is the point where the temperature and the dew point are equal.
Right.
So as the summer forms and the moisture, as Jim said, comes up, you get larger areas where the temperature and dew point are equal, and then the water condenses.
And that's also why in different times of the year, say winter versus spring versus summer, the cloud formations that tend to show up are different because the density of how much water you can shove into an atmosphere changes with temperature.
And then finally, if I can say something on top of all of that.
It's nice having four people, isn't it?
Yeah. During the winter, the variations in temperature on the Earth over an area are pretty constant. And as a result, you don't get major changes in barometric pressure between places. And what that does is it sort of equalizes the atmosphere to some extent. But if you have places, for example, in the summer where you've got an ocean and then you've got the land nearby, you get major changes. And that brings the water up into the atmosphere much faster and you wind up getting more fluffy clouds.
Ed, on one show, you and I think we all discussed how much clouds weigh. How much does the average cloud weigh?
Oh, they calculate it in terms of elephants. And the average cloud is on the order of 1,000 to 2,000 elephants. And I believe a hurricane is on the order of 10 billion elephants.
Well, why do they calculate it with elephants?
Well, it's good to know that they're up there in the air. Just above you.
All right, let's take a break. 800-348-2551 is our number. It's the Science Forum. Ed Stander, Barbara Brabets, Jim Pickett, and Roger Giboni. We'll be right back. It's Vox Pop on WAMC. Ray Graff here. Number is 800-348-2551. Oh, it's the Science Forum today, and what a fine time we are having. We have Barbara Brabets here and Ed Stander from SUNY Cobleskill, Jim Pickett, who is semi-retired, and he's very relaxed. It's nice to have him here. And our newcomer is Roger Giboni of Rogers High Fidelity, and we have a couple of emails here, and then we'll get to the phones again. This one came in from Jim, and the subject heading is Earth's Atmosphere. Hello, Ray, and esteemed scientist. Ooh. Singular. Which one of you is the esteemed scientist?
We'll have to do rock, paper, scissors.
All right. We'll just put an S on there. With the tonnage of carbon that's been released into the atmosphere during the last 200-plus years, especially during the last 40, has the weight of our atmosphere changed? If so, how has this weight change affected the organic and physical world? And that is from Jim.
So an oxygen molecule, which is the alternative to carbon dioxide, because that's kind of the switcheroo that we're doing in the atmosphere. We're switching a little bit of O2 for a little bit more CO2. That extra carbon is about a mass of 12 out of 44. So if you think about that, that's about a quarter. So there is a little bit more of a mass to the atmosphere. Yes. The funny thing is, it doesn't all stay in the atmosphere. As you increase the concentration of CO2 in the atmosphere, it comes in contact with other surfaces, particularly the ocean. And so there's a bit of dissolving of that carbon dioxide into the ocean, which forms an acid called carbonic acid, the same stuff that you get in your Coca-Cola. And so by the act of increasing the carbon dioxide concentration in the atmosphere, we're actually acidifying the ocean just a bit. This has larger ramifications for things like crustaceans, mollusks, animals that don't have an internal skeleton. They rely on a calcium barrier on the outside, and it's much harder to form a thick calcium barrier if you're acidified in the ocean.
All right.
So although we've added lots of tons of carbon as carbon dioxide, it's not enough to actually increase the atmospheric pressure in any measurable way.
Yeah, in fact, during the 60s, when that large, when there's a large period of time when in the East Coast we had lost all power because they'd stopped producing out west because of, mainly because of a solar flare. They went up and they looked at the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere during that period of time, and over a two-day period, the carbon dioxide dropped precipitously. So
this
it doesn't
1965?
1965. Yeah. So it doesn't stay in the atmosphere very long. It gets sucked up by the oceans pretty fast.
And it's kind of a steady state because, well, except for the man-made production. These processes are ones that are largely biological and geological, and they run at their own pace. And it's when you disrupt the apple cart that you end up with apples all over the street, right? So that it's the changing that we're making of that equilibrium that is influencing other factors.
All right, this email came in from Val. Here's a question. You ready? If moths are drawn to the light, why don't they come out in daytime?
Huh. Well, there's an awful lot of light everywhere, isn't there? It's like, I don't know. Well, you know, if music were only playing in one room of my house, I'd go to that room of my house to go dancing. But if music's playing everywhere in my house, I can dance wherever. Maybe they're out, but they're just not concentrated together.
So the premise may be incorrect. Maybe the moths are out in daylight.
Well, they are. They're feeding.
Okay. I'm not really a mothophile, so I don't know.
You know, Lepidoptera, not my thing. But,
okay, fair enough. Well, thank you for that email. The number here is 800-348-2551. It's the Science Forum. And Steve in Glenville. Steve, you're on.
Yeah, good afternoon. A physics question.
Ah, splendid.
Fusion is not commercially viable as a power generation method because it uses more energy to do than it produces or whatever. Is there a reason why we couldn't use fusion as a way to dispose of nuclear waste. We take things and we fusion produces something that's inert, presumably. And why couldn't we do that other than the cost?
Okay. Fusion requires a lot of energy to overcome the electrical repulsion of the atomic nuclei. So basically what we're talking about with fusion, like what occurs in the sun, is you're taking a couple of hydrogen nuclei, protons, and push them together right. enough so that it forms a new nucleus, a helium. Requires a lot of energy to get around that electrical repulsion. That's why it's really hard. Now, what drives fusion in the sun and what would drive fusion in a power reactor is the fact that in the process of doing that, the nucleus that you make has less mass than what you're starting with. And that mass is converted basically to energy.
E equals mc squared.
And you get that energy, and that's what drives the process. You stop getting energy from squeezing together nuclei at around iron on the periodic table. So if you try to squeeze together the heavier stuff that constitutes nuclear waste, it'll just fall back apart again.
Okay.
So even if you could theoretically do it, it will make something that's still radioactive and will fall back apart.
All right. Well, okay. Steve, thank you for that one. The number here is 800-348-2551. It's the Science Forum. Barbara Brabets, Ed Stander, Jim Pickett, and Roger Giboni are here to answer your questions. And Scott in Sunderland, Mass. is next. Scott.
Hi, everybody. I read recently an article about some MIT research using DNA, cellular DNA, and attaching digital code to it and using it as a potential storage device. I'm curious about the mechanics of that.
Well, there is a new biotech technology that was discovered about 10 years ago called CRISPR-Cas9. It's a naturally occurring mechanism that allows for gene editing. So up to about 10 years ago, we weren't able to take existing DNA and white out pieces that we didn't like and replace it with pieces that we did like. What we had to do is rewrite the whole DNA piece from beginning to end synthetically. And that was really expensive. So what CRISPR-Cas9 allows us to do is to say, oh, I have a typo in the third gene down on the left side of this chromosome. I want to replace the typo with something else. And it's just like a typewriter. You could go in and cover up the old letters and put in the new letters using CRISPR-Cas9. So this is a pretty cheap and fast in the scheme of biotech, nothing's really fast, but fast-ish method to be able to store information or to do, in the medical field, CRISPR-Cas9 is looked to fix a lot of the genetic defects that cause disease. So you could take CRISPR-Cas9, take an existing strand, and then store, rewrite, edit, overwrite information the way you would in a hard drive.
So, like, what sort of information are we talking about here?
You wouldn't want to use it like, I mean, ostensibly you could make a digital computer hard drive that's completely biological.
Yikes.
But it would not be fast. It would not be a fast rewrite.
Say it again, Scott.
I said we could program Artie Shaw right into Ray.
Oh, there you go.
Oh, well.
I'll make the microphone into a lamp like he did with his clarinet.
So the storage of information or data with DNA is one of those things which is, it's kind of a stunt. I mean, it's possible to do in principle.
Right. It's not fast. It's certainly not as fast as what we have now. It's not voluminous. There's not a gazillion genes that we have. You know, the number of genes that have been identified in the human body are limited to thousands. That's it. Now that might change as we figure out what the rest of the DNA does, but that's it. What it does do is give us a really good storage device that is impervious to EMPs, for example, has a copy, because DNA is double-stranded. and complementary, one side reads like a positive and the other side reads like a negative, and both are interpretable. And so you can check if there are errors in your device, and if one side doesn't match the other side, you know that there's been an error. So that's kind of the advantage of it, but it's just a stunt.
It's making, well, okay, now wait a minute. Thank you, Scott, for the call. Isn't today's stunt the groundwork sometimes for tomorrow's breakthrough?
Okay, so you can't be Artie Shaw because, sorry.
I don't want to be All Artie right. Shaw, although he had several beautiful wives, if I recall.
Ooh, now you're in trouble.
Well, I've got a beautiful wife, but I mean, you know.
As we've talked about here on the show before, memory isn't encoded in DNA from what we can tell. It's encoded in RNA, and that's always been a big debate in the bio world. Like, where do our memories get stored? Where's instinct stored?
Right.
But it seems that it's an RNA thing. It's kind of slimmer. DNA cousin. CRISPR-Cas does not work on our RNA. It works expressly on double-stranded DNA. So we don't have the ability right now to imprint memory on someone using CRISPR-Cas9.
All I'm saying is, just because we don't have a good use for it now doesn't mean 100 years from now this is a tremendous thing.
Right. I mean, but the CRISPR-Cas9, we know as scientists that this is going to revolutionize medicine.
Yeah.
It's a technique that 10 years ago was limited to a few labs, and now you can buy a kit with a credit card and have it sent to your undergraduate lab, and students in my bio course can do it.
Wasn't that the software that the Chinese used when they, it was CRISPR?
The CRISPR technology was supposedly used to rewrite a human embryo in China.
Right. Oh, yeah.
But there's really no proof that it was done. That really could have been a stunt. And of course, the ethical considerations of writing and rewriting human genomes has been discussed and will continue to be discussed.
Yeah, but for a real computer to be made out of it, we're going to have to wait for CRISPR-Cas 15 or 16.
Right.
It's the Science Forum on WAMC. Ed Stander, Barbara Brabets, Jim Pickett, and Roger Giboni are here, and the number is 800-348-2551. Carolyn, where are you calling from?
Poughkeepsie.
Ah, okay. Well, you're on.
Okay. I recall from years ago hearing about the transpiration rate of trees and being impressed at the volume of water that a single tree will suck up over the course of a 24-hour period. And so I'm curious whether, given climate change and the rising seas and so on, I don't know whether we could catch up fast enough, but if we restored forestation, might that help reduce some of the difficulties that are rapidly encroaching?
You mean with carbon dioxide?
No, flooding.
With water.
Oh,
water,
with water.
Transpiration and rate of water.
That's actually actively going on in the Adirondacks right now. They plant to manage the flooding in the Adirondacks.
Right, and it also helps with erosion, too. DEC has a whole program called Trees for Tribs. Which is Trees for Tributaries.
Oh.
So you can contact them through their web interface, and they will send you trees to plant along the banks. And they even give you a map of where to plant along the banks of creeks so that it can control water and control erosion.
Yeah, but on a global scale, you've got the problem that as the trees are transpiring, they're producing clouds. The clouds are producing rain, and the rain is coming back into the system.
Yes.
Yeah.
So there's too much energy in the system.
Yeah,
it's the energy transfer that causes our problems, because it's not the amount of rain, it's like when the rain comes down all at once. That's the problem.
And the primary action of the trees is to slow the runoff.
Correct.
Rather than transpiring the water. Because even though it's an impressive amount of water in terms of floods, it's not a lot.
It does stabilize the banks in some, which also help with the human impact of flooding.
But that's about it.
Yeah.
All right, Carolyn, thanks for the call. It's 800-348-2551, the Science Forum, and Ryan in Albany. Ryan.
Hey, how are you today? I'm a math professor, and I often, when I'm teaching in the classroom, I have a lot of, there's often classrooms that have the periodic table of elements. I'm not really an expert in chemistry, but I know from my basics that covalent bonds happen when two atoms are trying to get their outer electron shells to match up. So my question is, why is there two atoms in the first shell and then eight and then eight and then 16? Why don't we ever see an electron shell that has four atoms?
Four electrons. Right. So I'll give you my big bugaboo that I have about the way chemistry is taught. We were all taught that there are shells, that these shells are specific locations, they're distances from the nucleus, uh-huh. that there's two and then eight and eight and then 18. And it's all baloney. It's not how the electrons are arranged around a nucleus. The electrons in quantum mechanics are arranged around the nucleus so that they do occupy what we call orbitals instead of orbits. Those orbitals have shapes. Those shapes are spherical, dumbbell, kind of like four-lobed, and then even more complex. The ones that are spherical hold two. The dumbbells hold six, or two each, and there's three different types, so it's six. So each of the different shapes holds two electrons. We call one spin up and one spin down, but they really are energy identical electrons that occupy this space 90% of the time. It's difficult to do on the radio.
Are they the same distance from the nucleus?
No, the distance is not fixed. The only place an electron cannot be is the nucleus. Everywhere else is available.
So this is really just a way to visualize it?
Yeah, and it's baloney, but it was... It allowed the math in the early 19th century to be explained. The math came first. The concept matched the math. Niels Bohr put this out there, won a Nobel Prize. When he won the Nobel Prize, the Nobel Committee knew he was wrong, but they gave it to him anyway.
Ah, oh, boy.
It still propagates in every silly textbook, and it drives me nuts.
Yeah, we still teach it that way to
some
extent.
It's like the tooth fairy being in your science book. It's baloney.
Well, I hope that made your day, Ryan.
Right, but don't tell my daughter the tooth fairy's not real.
I didn't say anything. I just said the tooth fairy shouldn't be in my science book.
All right, thanks for the call. Let's go over to line five and Chris in Saugerties. Chris, you're on.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I have a question about electricity.
Okay.
If an electrical current is electrons moving along a wire, the only way that I can visualize that in my head is to think about it sort of like plumbing, where you have this store of electrons and they get pumped into a pipe. In this case, it would be the wire. So where are those electrons coming from? And once they get spent, you would think that the source would dry up.
All right, let's hand this one over to our electrical engineer, Roger Giboni.
Well, that's more of a chemistry question. I mean, the electrons don't – we're not changing the chemical structure of the copper wire in the generator by generating electricity
right.
from the flow of electrons. We're so inducing the current from the magnetic –
It's the work that the electrons do, right?
I'm sorry?
So rather than it be the drops of water in the plumbing that are moving – it's the work that the electron does as it pushes against.
My understanding is the electrons actually move from molecule from atom to atom.
But it's just a handoff.
But it's a result of the changing magnetic field. We go back to Maxwell's equations. As long as we induce a changing magnetic field, we get this flow of electrons.
Right.
But we're not structurally changing the atomic structure of the wire. Therefore, we don't run out of electrons.
Well, it's just a big hand-holding exercise. The electrons getting passed around like a hot potato in a loop. That's why if you don't have a ground, you can't get a current.
Right.
There has to be a beginning and an end, and that loop needs to be connected. So it's not actually the electrons themselves that are the quote-unquote charge. It's the motion of the electron and the force that that electron produces that we consider the electricity.
Yeah, the plumbing analogy is not a bad one at all, but you have to think of not a pipe going from point A to point B, but a loop. It goes all the way around in a circle, and you have a pump, and the pump is going to be a generator, or the pump is going to be a chemical battery. But so the electrons don't get used up; they just get pushed around the loop, and what's doing the pushing, the magnetic fields from a generator or the chemical potential.
But in the case of the chemical battery, you actually do run out of it.
No, only because there's an anode and a cathode, and one gets used up.
Yeah, you move them from one side of the battery to the other side, but they're all still there.
Well, you know, it's really just a hand-holding exercise, right?
It is a hand-holding exercise.
Just like public radio. It's 800-348-2551. The Science Forum Ed Stander, Jim Pickett, Roger Jaboni, Barbara Brabets. More questions, more answers, hopefully, coming up. Vox Pop, the Science Forum, Ray Graff with you at 800-348-2551. Ed Stander, Barbara Brabets, Jim Pickett, and Roger Jaboni are here to answer your questions. And Barbara, there was a topic that we discussed a while ago on this program. I don't know if it was the last show or several shows ago, about changing blood types. I forget, but it was very confusing, and you have more information on it.
Sure. So researchers at the University of British Columbia have been trying to perfect making universal blood out of type A negative blood. So
that the most common?
It's second most common. O is the most common.
Why
which
not
is
pick
great.
The most common?
Because O is fine.
Okay.
We're trying to make more blood out of what we have available from donation.
Gotcha.
So what happens is, if you have type A blood, you have a protein that sticks out from your red blood cells. It's a glycoprotein, which means it's a sugar. And that your immune system does not recognize. So if it's put into you and you don't have that normally on your red blood cells, your body attacks it and creates an immune response. Like you have a splinter in your finger, but think of it throughout your whole body.
Yeah.
It creates pus and stuff like that. So that you can't transfuse blood that your body can't recognize. So if you're a B or an O blood type and you get A blood, you'll get sick. And B type blood is the same thing, a different protein on the surface of your red blood cell, but the same kind of thing.
Yeah.
O blood has no proteins on the outside of that red blood cell that can be recognized. So what they wanted to do is to take A blood, they fed it to a bacteria that they got from the gut of people, because we eat sugar all the time and we have already selected, our bodies have already selected for bacteria that like sugars.
Yeah.
And they fed A-type blood cells to the bacteria and looked to see which ones could kind of lick off the plate, so to speak, get the glycoproteins off the surface of the cell, thus taking an A-type blood cell and making it an O-type blood cell.
Yeah.
And they published their material, their findings in April, that they can effectively now take A-negative blood and make it O-negative blood by giving E. coli a little dinner of blood and then stopping the process after it's just chewed off the sugar from the outside of the blood cells.
Is this a tremendous breakthrough?
This allows us to our blood supply is really limited by volunteers. Artificial blood still isn't there. We really rely on people donating blood. This O blood can be given to anybody at this table because it doesn't have anything on the outside surface. All of our bodies will accept it as okay.
Yeah.
So this allows hospitals to have a larger stash of O blood when someone walks in the door after a gunshot or after an operation and they need a lot of blood.
Yeah.
So this would be quite a breakthrough.
Well, I've told our intern is type O, so we're all set.
We're just going to bleed her dry.
If a knife fight breaks out here at Studio A,
all right.
We're all set.
Well, I may be. I'm the universal acceptor. I can take anybody's blood.
All right, Jackie. So. Yeah, why don't you draw a couple of pints just
that's
in
right.
case. Thank you very much.
I got the cup ready.
Oh, it's the Science Forum, 800-348-2551. Let's go over to Stephen in Gansfort. Stephen.
Gentlemen and lady, this is a question for your resident doctor of tubology.
Ah.
Here we go. I had some tremendous tube amps in my younger years and have always been told by aficionados that the sound of a tube amp is so much better than that of a solid state amp, though I've never been able to personally detect any discernible difference. Can you explain where this idea came from and what the difference is?
I can at least give you a plausible explanation. The I'm careful to say that one is not better than the other. The primary difference between the way solid state devices and tube devices amplify is, again, goes back to the physics of the device. Solid-state devices are current devices. Vacuum tubes are thermionic devices. They work on an electric charge rather than a current through a junction. Noise in nature is a function of temperature and is a thermionic effect. Okay, it's a function of temperature, bandwidth, and Boltzmann's constant. When you listen to music, the thing that makes the music sound differently is not the transient sound of the note, but the noise between the notes. It's what's between the notes, the black background, the noise in the background. And tubes, because they amplify noise in a much more natural method, have a different sound than solid-state devices. To my ear, solid-state devices tend to sound a lot more harsher. They're not as deep sounding. They don't have the background. But that's my ear. I like the tube sounds have almost a hiss associated with the noise. And it's actually the electrons that you're hearing going through the device.
My question, though, would be if you have a good microphone system and you're recording it, aren't you actually recording those sounds in the first place? So the amplifier should only be amplifying those sounds rather than adding to it.
And that's true, but as all devices in nature, there is some distortion that's created as a function of the amplification, and it's that noise that we hear as the difference between solid state and tube devices.
So people who make
Go ahead, Stephen.
No, go ahead. Finish.
My question was, if that's true, then are we trying to design solid-state devices that produce noise so that they mimic what the sound is
and
from
they
the
do.
Tubes?
With digital signal processing, you can do that.
Uh-huh. Interesting.
But you don't get the warm glow of a vacuum tube.
Oh. And the heating up of the entire room. Stephen, go ahead with your follow-up.
Not a follow-up on this, but on a prior question, the analogy of the electron transfer in copper pipe. Is it better to use something akin to the idea of a wave, where the electron at the beginning is not the identical labeled, so to speak, electron at the other end, but that it transfers to other electrons along the way, like a wave transfers force from one end to another, but the water molecules at the beginning are not the same as the water molecules at the end.
I see heads nodding up and down and back and forth.
Well, there are electrons that physically jump from one atom to another atom. But then electrons have, the ownership of electrons is really just which master they abide by. All electrons are created equal in their mass and in their charge, but their affinity or assignment, who owns them, this quantum mechanical idea of ownership, is really just who they associate with. So,
If I may.
Yeah, go ahead.
Thank you.
I think one of the best ways to...
Thank you.
Okay, one of the best ways to think about it is just go into your car and rub yourself against the car seat for a little while.
Which we've all done,
yes,
let's be honest.
And then touch the metal on the side. And those things are jumping. They're not forming a wave structure. In other words, they're not going around in a circle and staying in the same place. They are actually moving from one point to another.
Okay. This email came in from Dale. My question is directed to everyone on the panel. What are the next big advances on the horizon? What is being worked on now that we may see in the near future? That is from Dale. Jim, you've been silent.
I'm not so silent. I think probably the most exciting things that'll affect people are in the biological side, and
ooh,
the biochemistry.
Thanks, Jim.
As Barbara was saying, with being able to manipulate genes down to the molecular level, of fixing flaws in that, of determining the, for example, using that kind of technology to fight cancer.
Yeah. Fight cancer in a way that doesn't make you so sick while you're fighting it.
That's right. Mm. I mean, basically, chemotherapy tries to kill the cancer before it kills you.
Yep.
Whereas it would be possible to design much better targeted drugs.
That's really already started. Yeah. In the last 5 years, these monoclonal antibody therapies using your own immune system to go after just the cancer and not you. So if you see like ipilimumab on TV, the mab part of ipilimumab means it's a monoclonal antibody. And that means, yes, it's an expensive therapy, but it's highly effective. You don't lose your hair. You don't throw up. It's a much better therapy, especially for intractable cancers.
You guys are so small. No, the big things that are going to be coming up are going to be in astronomy.
There's
no question.
Like what?
It's those graviton waves. That's gonna change our lives.
We're gonna figure out who this God guy is.
Really? Do you really think so?
Well, we're coming to the point where we're starting to actually figure out how everything fits together, from the smallest size to the largest size. And we start figuring out what's going on in other dimensions, then we've got something to play with.
Yeah, I think it's a pretty big leap.
I think aerospace.
I think there's some great advancements going on in aerospace with microsats and the way we're now going to, instead of launching big, large satellites, we're launching low Earth orbit microsats that are going to allow communications all over the world right from your phone.
Don't we have too much communication already?
I don't have internet at my house.
That may be, but it's getting simpler, faster, wider bandwidth, cheaper. And you got guys like Elon Musk that are just changing the landscape of the aerospace.
Did you see those satellites? They put up a string of satellites, and astronomers are not all that jazzed about this.
Yeah.
They're very bright, and there's lots of them.
I've said on this program, and I'm not going to compete with a grand unified theory of everything. However, I think in 10 years we're going to be able to grow a new set of teeth, and
nice.
I'm thrilled about
that's
that.
That's very good.
Yes, we are going to fix cancer, but you think about the commerce of it all. We're going to be able to epigenetically change our hair color. We don't have to go to the, we can just say we want blue hair, we dial in, we take a pill, and our hair grows blue. I could see all kind of commercialization
here. That's 200 dentists out of work. And think about what that's going to do to the golfing.
No, they're going to have to inject the stem cells into my mouth.
All right.
So they're going to have just a different job to do.
Right.
But
well,
I can't wait for the new teeth.
That's all well and good. Let's go back to the phones. Erickson in Poughkeepsie, you're on.
Oh, yes. Hi. I was considering that during the winter, there are trillions of trees that lose their leaves. And we know that trees produce oxygen. And I suspect that there must be an impact in the atmosphere in the both northern and southern hemispheres when that season comes. I was wondering how would the atmosphere and the weather change if we had coniferous trees instead than having nothing at all during the winter time.
There is a fluctuation of about 10 parts per million per year per season from just about this time in the Northern Hemisphere until about the end of December, early January. So we do see this sinusoidal fluctuation of our CO2 level because of terrestrial photosynthesis. Please realize, though, that equatorially around the equator, there's not really a season change. So photosynthesis in that area takes place all year round. And then, of course, the southern hemisphere is kind of the yin to the northern hemisphere's yang.
True.
But there's not an even distribution of, not a really good even distribution of terrestrial real estate in the southern hemisphere versus the northern hemisphere. So the northern hemisphere really runs that sinusoidal cycle. Half of photosynthesis, though, takes place in the oceans and by small organisms called phytoplankton. And that's where half of our CO2 and O2 exchange takes place.
All right. Thanks for the call. Let's go quickly to Greg in East Meredith. Greg, you're on.
Yeah, hi. What a great segue. I'm a retired professor of botany, and I have another. It's related to the previous caller's question. We all know that carbon dioxide levels increase in the winter time, but you never hear about, does the oxygen level decrease in the winter time? And if it doesn't, why doesn't it? Because plants aren't obviously photosynthesizing in the winter.
I don't know that we actively... So Mauna Loa volcano in Hawaii is the place that we use. It's kind of isolated by itself, not really influenced by the rest of what's going on in Maui. Maui. It's on Maui. So that's where we monitor CO2. Other places are monitoring around the world, but they're influenced by anthropogenic distribution, stuff that we do. but it's CO2 that they look at. I don't know that they do O2.
I can tell you empirically, oxygen density increases in the wintertime.
Well, sure, because, again, that atmospheric colder, density right. thing. Yep.
But
I don't think I think we just kind of look at the big guy, CO2.
Yeah, because it's easier to see differences in the CO2 concentration
right.
because the concentration is low.
Right.
Seeing a few parts per million change in oxygen would simply be hard to measure because you're looking for a small change in a large quantity.
All right, we have about a minute here. We go to Randall in Ellington, Connecticut. Randall, you're on.
Yeah, hi, guys. I have a quick question for the science panel, and it's related to whether or not any of them believe in evolution versus creation.
Okay.
And how to explain the absolutely impossible
right.
situation that arises from evolution.
Okay, well, we only have about 30 seconds.
Two different sexes.
All right, so let's do this in 30 seconds, and we'll start with Barbara.
I think evolution and the idea of a religious story are compatible.
Yep, I would agree with that.
Okay. Ed?
I'm just going to sit this one out.
Really?
Yes.
How about you, Roger?
It doesn't connect with wires. I don't understand it.
You guys, you know, copping out big time, I'll tell you what. Well, I guess that's where we will have to leave it today. Support comes from Colby Attorney Service, document filing, documented information retrieval, and other services, including legal publishing on corporate record searches, ColbyService.com. Lakeview Orchard, 94 Old Cheshire Road, Lanesboro, Massachusetts. You pick and pre-picked tree fruits, berries, pies, pastries, cider donuts, galumki, pierogi, kapusta, kielbasa, lakevieworchard.com. Watercolors by Edith, Shutesbury, Massachusetts. Edith Hunsberger, a painter in acrylic and watercolors, specializing in portrait paintings of people and pets from photographs. Edith-Hunsberger.artistwebsites.com. And Identity Eyewear, Albany, New York, specializing in distinctive eyewear, European styling on prescription and non-prescription sunglasses, eye exams by appointment, EYEDENTITY Eyewear, Albany.com. Well, thank you all for listening. Great calls today. Thanks to our panel, Barbara Brabets, Ed Stander, Jim Pickett, and Roger Giboni for stopping by today. Thanks to our engineer, the long-suffering Zach Malloy. Jackie Orchard took the calls today. And also donated a couple of pints of blood when we had that knife fight about 20 minutes ago. Our producer is Jim Lavoulis. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow on Food Friday, we talk wine with Michael Drapkin of Kingston Wine Company and food writer and instructor Peter Barrett. Right now, though, stand by for the Capital Connection.